This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Poet and UNC professor Michael McPhee brings a little notebook in his pocket everywhere he goes and jots down the images and the phrases and the concepts that buzz through his mind and pass his eyes and ears during the day. Later, he sits down at a desk and tries to turn those seeds into full-blown pieces of writing. And it has worked out pretty well so far. The North Carolina native has published 11 books of poetry, and now he's out with a new collection of essays called Appointed Rounds. Inside, you will find lovingly crafted essays about the things that matter to Michael, whether that's the postal service, the word hillbilly, or the sensory delight of reading a book. And he joins us again on The State of Things. Michael McPhee, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Are you always writing essays? Do you keep those going on the side as you write your poems?
No, but there are times when whatever I'm trying to write just doesn't want to come forth in lines and stanzas. And because poetry is so much about concentrating and squeezing things down, and prose is a little more discursive. You can tease things out at more length. I think I approach these essays as I approach the poems, and that I'm trying to focus on something as closely as possible with as original language and imagery as I can get. But it's just not cast into a poem.
It's still about paying attention, though.
Yeah, as closely as possible. Yeah.
And had you always been? I mean, are your essays? Do your poems come out of these same jottings as your essays? In other words, you keep these notebooks.
They do. The notebooks are the piece of paper that I carry in my pocket. And then, as you say, I'll go to my desk and see if it can stir itself into something. And most of them don't. I mean, most of them don't turn into something substantial. But sometimes something will emerge and I'll think, that's just not going to concentrate into a poem. I need more length. And I'll take months to work on that. And poems usually take a little shorter time than that.
I want to stay with that idea, though, because, you know, your poetry and the poetry of other great and good poets does take on really meaty, powerful stuff. And you know, when I read your poetry and others, I think, how did they do that? How did you pack so much into so little? So I guess my ultimate question here is, how do you know the difference? When does something actually become so big it just won't fit into a poem?
Yeah. And the honest answer is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just feel that it won't make that shape. And I just need more time and space to do it. And I wrote prose for many years. I actually did book reviews for WUNC back in the day and for The Spectator magazine when it existed. So I've always written prose, and I like prose. I'm not going to say it's easier than poetry, but it's a different sort of verbal pressure.
And the artifact itself, the way it comes out, the form matters. And in fact, you've written about the form of the book, a sensual experience in and of itself.
I have, because I have nothing against digital technology at all, but I think there is something, as you and I were talking about, important about holding a finished volume in your hand as a 3D object. In fact, I have a little essay about it if you'd like to hear it.
Why would you?
Yes. It's the first essay in the book, and it's called A Body. A book has a body to which my body responds. It has, like me, an anatomy. Its spine in my hand is a familiar, sometimes intimate fit. Reading a book is a sensory experience. I take in its words with my hungry eyes. I hear the pages whisper as they turn. I touch it gently, beginning to end. I smell the tang of a new volume, the musk of an old one. And though I may not taste a book, I have been known to lift one to my lips upon finishing and kiss it, like a grateful priest after the gospel reading. A book's body, like mine, ages. Light hurts it over the long haul. Some hardbacks wear a jacket for protection. The pages of a book can yellow and crack and fox, developing stains and spots like the skin of the hands holding it. And yet, the acid-free paper of the volumes I have written will survive me, which is a gratifying version of immortality, my name vertical on many spines instead of merely horizontal on a single gravestone. Even if no one takes those books down and reads them, they will exist when I do not. Books are three-dimensional creations. That's how we 3D creatures need to encounter them in a world of height and width and depth, not on the flatness of a screen. A bookshelf is a dormitory. Go wake a body up.
There we go. North Carolina author Michael McPhee reading A Body, an essay from his new book called Appointed Rounds. It's so funny. You know, we talked about this. We were talking about it before the segment began. And I particularly like the Library of America series, the way it kind of whole falls open and can fit so beautifully in your palm. And yet, I read better and more easily on a Kindle, to be honest. It's the most amazing thing. But I can actually scan better, and it has to do with probably some eye problem that I have. Fascinating thing. But you point out something other than the sensual experience of holding the book, which is amazing, and smelling, particularly an older book. And that's that a book has a kind of a history. You can sense it. And a future, right?
One hopes.
Yeah.
It's why we do these things called books and write these poems and essays and hope that they'll be around when we're not. And I think you can't count on it, but it's the kind of immortality writers aim for, probably.
This is not your first book of essays. You wrote another book in
2006. I did. Back in 2006, I had a book called The Napkin Manuscripts, which is about how I used to jot notes on napkins in the car when I was driving. Still part of that process of paying attention.
Is this different than that, do you think?
It is different. It was composed in a shorter period of time, and I think it coheres a little better, Frank, because there are these essays, some of which are very short, like short as a sentence, about the physical book, one of which I just read. There are some short essays about writers and writing. There's some essays about being a teacher and being in the classroom. And then there are longer personal essays about growing up in the mountains or just being in North Carolina in general, a place I love dearly.
And place has always been important to you in your poetry. Growing up in the mountains is the subject of one of your essays, My Inner Hillbilly, for instance.
Yeah. Again, that was not something I set out to write. But as with a lot of things I write, it was triggered by a word and the sound of the word. And that word was hillbilly. I'd grown up around the word, and maybe I heard somebody say it, and maybe with a particular angle on it. And I thought, where did that word come from? And that's really what triggered this essay.
Will you read it or parts of it?
Sure. I'll read a couple of the really short sections. This is from the beginning of My Inner Hillbilly. In an interview a few years ago, I described my long-haired, flannel-shirted, lonesome undergraduate self as a hillbilly doofus. Where did that come from? Not the second word, doofus, which was and is accurate, but the first of all the words in the world I could have picked. Why hillbilly? And a little farther on. I love a juicy etymology, and you might think that hillbilly has one, but not really. The American Heritage Dictionary, first edition on my writing desk for decades, says it comes from, quote, hill plus billy, pet form of William, whatever that means. The Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English says, origin obscure, attested only since 1900, which makes it, ironically, a modern term. The Encyclopedia of Appalachia says it was first used in a New York newspaper to describe someone who, quote, lives in the hills, has no means to speak of, dresses as he can, talks as he pleases, drinks whiskey when he gets it, and fires off his revolver as the fancy takes him, unquote. So, the noun hillbilly may have been invented by a 20th century Yankee broadcasting the seeds of idle, uncouth, regional stereotypes in his original description. Did that doom the word from the very start?
Hillbilly. Michael McPhee, poet, UNC Chapel Hill professor, and author of The Appointed Rounds, which is his latest book of essays. The sound of words, too, not only sort of where did Hill and Billy get mashed together to create that image, that strong imagery. I remember my oldest grandson, when he was about three, we threw some Hoppin' John in his plate. He said, What's this, Papa? I said, Hoppin' John. He looked at me and went, Hoppin' John.
Yeah, right.
And he repeated it like Hoppin' John, like that. And he found 1,000 different ways to say Hoppin' John. The sound of it just.
That's wonderful.
He, by the way, didn't eat it. It didn't taste good.
No, but it sounded good.
No matter how great it sounded, Hoppin' John didn't taste quite right to him. Writing books. So when you teach writing, are you teaching, sort of focus on the form that you, I suppose, concentrate on a particular form? We're going to write an essay now. Here's a poem.
Yeah, and I teach poetry writing at UNC, and as my intro students know, maybe to their dismay, at the beginning of class, I want them to focus as intensely as possible on things, because I think essays can be a little more generalized, a little more abstract, a little more thought-driven, and I really want them to be as sensory as possible and write the most intense poem that's ever been written about a fire hydrant or something like that. And they do a really good job of that.
Do you spend time nurturing attention before you even pick up a pen? Remember those?
Since I started out long ago in design school, I was going to be an architect. Yeah. And one thing I did was draw a lot. And though I don't draw anymore, I think there's something about seeing intensely and seeing angles. I know I mentioned a fire hydrant earlier. I remember when I was at NC State in design school, spending 2 or 3 hours staring at a fire hydrant. I'm sure someone thought I was stoned out of my gourd,
right.
But I was just trying to get everything about it before I put pen to paper. And there's a lot of time before you actually get, whether you're drawing or writing, things are in your head that you're trying to figure out how to approach them in the best way and how to trigger them on the page, whether it's a poem or an essay.
And then you get, I suspect you get a little better at that. I mean, in other words, you may not have to spend an hour and a half or 5 hours looking at the fire hydrant.
Since I gave up the visual side, I can't say, but it's certainly been true for the verbal side. I think writing is one of those arts, or one of those things you learn by doing. And I've been doing it for a long time, so it may not take quite as long to trigger the poem or the essay as it used to, but it takes a long time to get it right.
Yeah. Appointed rounds, that phrase inspired by the U.S. Postal Service, unofficial motto, right?
Yeah, and it's actually from Herodotus, I discovered. I didn't realize I went back that far. Ooh. It's an adaptation of it. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. My dad was a postal worker, and I heard that from an early age, and it's just a very grand pronouncement. But it also seemed to me that besides the Postal Service, which I am obsessed with the mail, and there's the longest essay in the book is about that, I think we all have appointed rounds in our lives, things that we really must do or that we really want to pay attention to. And this book collects some of mine.
Yeah, well, there's that word attention. I mean, when you think about the people like you and I, and we've talked about this, who are so blessed and fortunate to be doing precisely the things we want to do.
Very lucky.
And then think about those who, for one reason or another, can't quite get there and don't seem to have that joy.
Yeah, or who have a job or a career or a life that actually doesn't allow them the luxury of slowing down and paying that attention. I think one thing I try to tell my students and try to practice myself is the great thing about poetry is it slows you down. But you don't rush through a poem, writing it or reading it. You take your time. You savor it in your mouth, in your ear, in your body, which is wonderful.
Well, and silence probably plays a bigger role in poetry than any form of writing. What you don't say is maybe more important than what you say.
Sure. Again, you look at a poem on a page, and much of the page is often white. There's this blankness surrounding the poem, so it's sort of existing in this sea of silence. And that's why every syllable, every phoneme in a poem is essential.
You also, as it turns out, have written an essay here about Billy Graham, the late Billy Graham.
Yes. My wife and I and her brother and her now late mother, my mother-in-law, went to the Billy Graham Library in Charlotte some years ago. It was our birthday gift to my wife's mother because she was a good Baptist lady. And so I went along, and the Billy Graham Library is a very curious place, and I did indeed commit an essay about it.
Well, could you read some for us?
I would be glad to read a little bit from it. And the essay, the title of the essay is a twist on a familiar hymn title. It's called Just As I Am Not. Music is in the very air at the Billy Graham Library. From the moment you leave the massive asphalt parking lot, hymns rise like a holy fog from the ground through squat green speakers lining the sidewalks and crossing the grass, constantly piping, Great is Thy Faithfulness, or All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name. It's vaguely soothing and a bit spooky, as if you're standing above a choir in a cavern or walking over lost souls stranded in subterranean purgatory on the outskirts of Charlotte, who lift up their heads and sing to us humans still on the surface of earth, Let every kindred, every tribe on this terrestrial ball to Him all majesty ascribe and crown Him Lord of all. And a little later in the essay, and then it hits me. If this is a library, where are the books? Isn't every library, even a presidential library, a sympathetic legacy-shaping memorial, which we were told this place is like, composed of volumes and documents and papers, lots of them? There are copies of the book throughout the exhibits, but the only actual collection of books at the Billy Graham Library is found here on the shelves of Ruth's Attic Gift Shop for purchase at the end of the tour or the beginning, if you choose not to go through the maze representing the phases of Billy's, quote, journey from the pastures and gravel roads of North Carolina, unquote. Gravel roads? Was somebody listening to Lucinda Williams and Car Wheels? Given all the Piedmont clay hereabouts, red dirt roads would be more like it. Surely this word-driven minister had his own library, volumes he liked to have around him in his office as he worked on sermons or columns or his own books. I'd love to see what lined his shelves. Reading does shape thinking, after all. Maybe his study has been preserved at the Billy Graham Training Center at the Cove on the eastern edge of Asheville in the Blue Ridge Mountains, a few hours west of here, or maybe it's to be reproduced somewhere else. But I do wish they'd moved at least some of his books, pages of words that once filled those big hands to this library.
Michael McPhee, an essay from an essay called Just As I Am Not, and that is from his latest collection of essays called Appointed Rounds. You know, it's curious. You think about the power of words and the power of Billy Graham through words, right? 2 billion people, we think, have heard those words, hundreds of thousands gathering in tents, hanging on every word. What do you suppose is the difference between those words that somehow reach people in great numbers, masses of numbers, and the power of poetry, which has its power and yet seems not to reach so many people? What's going on?
Well, I think poetry is, and honestly has always been, a much more private or maybe small-scale art. Even when it was in the courts and you had the courtier poets, not that many people were really writing or reading poetry or listening to it. And, you know, Billy Graham brought his gospel message, you know, based on a book which many people treasure and read and believe, and to many believe it quite seriously. Every word is inerrant. And he did this in arenas. So I think it was partly a matter of scale. And I went to a Billy Graham crusade. I talk about this in the essay back when I was in college. And it is pretty stirring theater. I mean, it's powerful. And it's no surprise that many people go down and accept the altar call. But it's very different from writing or reading or sharing a poem.
Well, I'm so happy that you share your poetry and your writing with us as frequently as you do. Michael McPhee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Michael McPhee is a poet. His new book is called Appointed Rounds. That's a collection of essays about everything from the Postal Service to what it means to be a hillbilly. Michael is also a teacher of creative writing at the UNC Chapel Hill. And he has lots of book readings coming up, including Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Sunday, February 25th. And, of course, we've got all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.